chill, keeping you company during the coronavirus.
Yo, this is Michael Payne, and I host the Michael and Marcel Show on FUBAR Radio every Wednesday from 4 till 6 p.m. Thanks for staying at home. The only thing we want you to catch is a vibe. You're listening to Stay Home and Chill on FUBAR Radio, keeping you company through the coronavirus.
Marcel Somerville and Michael Payne on FUBAR Radio.
We're going to get straight into the first interview of the day. Because of, like, recent developments with the whole Piers Morgan virus, this artist...
was supposed to be in studio
was supposed
today,
to and, be so,
and
right
will
here
be
in
at
our
some
midst.
Point. We're so
and
excited.
Hopefully will be, yeah. But for now, we're going to have to speak to him on the phone all the way from Germany. Mm-hmm. Make some noise for Zebra Cats. Can you hear us?
How's it going? I can hear you loud and clear.
Wicked, yeah, perfect. likewise. And did I pronounce it right? Because we were having a bit of a debate as to whether it's pronounced zebra or zebra, and I took a punt with zebra, but only because you're American.
Absolutely. Zebra fucking cat.
Yeah, well, so Natalie and Marcel were actually right. I was saying zebra earlier on, but only because obviously we're British, but then I realised it was you who named yourself, I'm assuming.
Yes, absolutely.
You weren't just looking like a zebra and a cat at the same time one day.
No.
Where did
that was not the mixture.
Where did the name come from?
I kind of just came up with the name when I was studying in college in New York, and I was emceeing at, like, clubs at the time.
Yeah.
That was still open. And, I would, like, on the mic and kind of freestyle and try to get everyone kind of hype. And one day, Zebra Cats kind of just stuck. I knew I wanted to have an animal name, and I know I also wanted it to end with another Z, so Zebra Cats was it.
Of course. It rolls off the tongue, whether you say zebra or zebra. Do you get a lot of people saying, like, you know, if you travel to the UK and people are talking to you, do a lot of people call you zebra, or do they kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's the most exciting thing about it. If you listen to the album, it kind of starts with a plight of different news presenters saying zebra cats in different languages. So
amazing.
It kind of just kind of shows my journey over the last 8 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the fun interviews that I've done. And,
yeah,
it's fun. You know, as long as they know your name, there's nothing wrong with that.
Fair play. Very self-aware. How come it took you so long to release your debut album?
I was spending a lot of time just learning about the industry and preparing myself to be able to independently release on my own label, ZFK Records. And, you know, I had to put a team together, and there's a lot of awesome people behind me right now that are just really looking forward to pushing this out tomorrow night, basically, on March 20th. So,
yes, of course.
Yeah, it's exciting times, and I kind of just needed to learn the ropes a little bit and learn what it is I wanted to present as a musician.
Yeah.
At the same time that I was kind of growing in front of my fan base and experimenting as an artist. So,
Obviously, it's really fucking annoying that you had a tour scheduled and everything that I'm hoping only rescheduled rather than cancelled.
Postponed.
There we go. But do you see the silver lining as people have just got, like, more time to sit in and sit down and take in the album now?
Vibe to the tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. It's unfortunate that I couldn't be there to present it live, because we spent a lot of time working on a live show and, you know, spent a lot of time learning the new material to present it, because I've been touring with a lot of the older material for the last 7 years now, so I was really looking forward to presenting it in that way. But yeah, I'm glad that people will be able to, in confinement, listen to the album. And, you know, hopefully it eases them. It does have moments of apocalyptic doom throughout it, so it might be an easing sound to take in. But yeah, I don't know. I'm really just looking forward to getting it out. We're living in some trying times, so I know I'm not the only musician or individual that has been affected by this. And just trying to stay positive and, you know, get on with the work.
Yeah. I think the only bands right now that are probably still gigging are The Who and The Vaccines and The Cure. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm sure of it.
So you moved to Germany. Was that a recent move, or has that been?
Yeah, I did that in 2017, and then as soon as I relocated, was invited to go on the road with the Gorillaz for a year.
Wicked.
So didn't really get back into early 2018, and then just kind of isolated myself, which I'm doing now.
Yeah.
And worked on an album, and you know, was looking forward to touring it. So. Yeah, that's why I kind of relocated here and was going to play it by ear. But, you know, I may move back to the States. I may stick it out here. But, yeah.
Whereabouts in Germany specifically you live in?
In Berlin.
Oh, it is Berlin. Yeah, I was going to say the kind of architecture around there must really lend itself to a kind of post-apocalyptic, like, mindset.
Yeah, it's quite brutalist.
It is,
you know,
isn't
but there's also some romance to it. There's a lot of concrete dance floors that kind of play into the club, you know, atmosphere that's been shut down. But it's a great space. I've had a lot of freedom here to kind of explore and not have the financial burden I had when I was living in New York City. Being a freelancer, a person that works from home on the computer mostly or in the studio, there's a lot of guilt and pressure that, like, you constantly have to be working. And I think when I moved to Berlin, I had a moment to kind of digest and, you know, settle in and reflect on the nomadic lifestyle I've had since 2012 with the release of Amarid. So, you know, it was a moment of clarity for me also, because I had been gigging a majority of the time that I wasn't in the public eye, so to say. So it was nice to take that time off after touring and then going on the road for a year with the Gorillaz and to kind of just like settle and get a piece or a body of work out and build a team and, you know, get it out and get it on vinyl thanks to the Vinyl Factory, which is something I definitely wanted to have a physical piece because I think it's really important and a lot of people resonate with it, and it's been nice to see people listening to it and, you know, mixing and mastering a vinyl was a new experience for myself. So glad I got to go through that process, and I'm excited to finally share it and have people take it in.
Well, obviously you're known mainly as a musician, but you're a multidisciplinary kind of creative, and you when you kind of first started, you spent quite a lot of time gigging in like galleries and museums. So was there as well as the kind of musical influences, did you have any other main influences from like other art disciplines?
For sure. I mean, I grew up going to an art school, so we had to take a wheel where you experimented or like also practiced or trained in other mediums like dance and communication, which is like a form of doing the morning announcements or learning about film and learning about, you know, being a politician, so to say, or doing like political newscasting. And we also had keyboard class. So I mainly focused in theater, and that's kind of how the Zebra Cats project grew about when I was doing performance art. And I did a one-man show at La Mama Theater in downtown New York that, you know, I started experimenting with music in and also did some dancing in and, like, developed these several characters, and Zebra Cats was one of them. So I had a really versed upbringing, so to say, and that's what's been influenced for me in a lot of my work, from doing the music videos and executive producing them and working with teams in Lithuania or Riga or Sweden, you know, wherever I can really find people to trust in my vision and, like, you know, get the work done. And I'll also be releasing a new music video for the single called More on the 20th as well. And it was really fun working on another visual because it helps me, you know, give people a peekhole into the world of Zebra Cats, or the Zebra Zone, so to say. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. I get to, you know, reflect and work within a field I feel really confident in, and that's, you know, being in front of the camera or performing on stage and studying Shakespeare, so to say, at BARDA, the British American Dramatic Academy in the UK for a summer when I was also writing More Contradictions. So, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, experiences I've had as an artist growing up where I've had to make mistakes, where I kind of just feel really comfortable, you know, investing in my work and investing in my craft and putting it out there and hoping that people kind of resonate with it.
Excellent. That's fascinating stuff, man.
Access all areas with Joanna Shimonides and Stephen Lang on FUBAR Radio.
We now have one of the most, probably the most talked about men in the world at the minute.
Absolutely.
Dylan from the Tiger King. How are you?
Hi.
I'm doing good. How are y'all?
Good.
Thanks so much
for speaking to us. And we're both very excited to have you on, especially Joanna, who has literally just finished the series. So
I literally finished the series yesterday, so it's amazing. Have you watched it yet?
Oh, I've watched it like three times through, yeah.
How has this period of time been for you? I can imagine it's totally insane.
It's definitely been overwhelming. You know, a lot of people have been reaching out and kind of like interested in what I'm doing, and I'm not used to that. So it's definitely taken some getting used to.
Yeah. When did they finish filming?
So the last interview I did with them was in like January of 2019. But most of the footage that they have is just the stuff that Joe had saved on hard drives from like his years at the zoo. So, I mean, they didn't really film too much themselves. It was mostly just like, of Joe and I really, but
got it.
It was mostly just stuff that Joe already had.
How's your life changed now since the show? Because obviously before you had like obviously no fame, and then suddenly you had a load of fame, and it's one of like the most watched Netflix series. So how's your life changed since?
You know, people keep saying I'm a celebrity, and like, I do not feel like that whatsoever. I'm just like a normal dude. But now, so people keep calling me a celebrity. I'm like, I'm just a normal dude. Like, I do everything that everybody else does. It's not like I'm, you know, living in Hollywood or anything like that. So it's definitely been weird. People like wanting to take pictures and like reaching out to me. And I just found there's like a freaking Dylan Passage fan page on Instagram. I'm like, now I'm just waiting for the hate page, honestly.
Have you had, obviously there's been a lot of attention about how you look and about your relationship with Joe. Have you been getting a lot of attention, a lot of male attention since the show?
Oh, I mean, I've definitely received quite a few nudes from people, and it's just keep that to yourself. Like, I already know what a wiener looks like. I don't need to see what it's
doing. I do sometimes sit there and think, what is going through people's mind when they send that? Do they think I'm going to be like, wow, love that? Except.
Yes, that's awesome. Yeah, no, it's definitely not like that. No, I'm just like, delete, swipe, yeah.
Is that a bit difficult? Because obviously you're with someone who's in prison, and you know you're getting this attention from probably some very attractive people. Like,
I mean, you would think so, but it's mostly the very unattractive people that are reaching out. I mean, I feel like they are the most brave out of everybody. But no, I mean, it was definitely like really weird. I mean, obviously Joe's in jail; he's going to be in jail for a long time. And like, we've had the conversation that if like I decide to move on and find somebody, then he would support that because he doesn't want me to be alone forever.
And you're still very young as well, right?
Yeah.
But even if I did decide to move on, you know, I would still have Joe in my life. I'd still talk to him daily. So it's just nothing I'm looking for right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Have you had any temptations today, or is it just been strictly like, no, I'm done, not yet?
No, I mean, really, I'm just focused on myself. I don't need to fill any kind of void. Like, I don't feel like I'm missing something in my life, like in my love life. Because, I mean, I do have contact with Joe and, you know, I was going to say something, but I probably shouldn't say that.
Say whatever you like.
But yeah, so I'm not trying to like, I don't need anybody else to kind of make me feel better about myself.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. What was it that first attracted you to Joe?
So the first time I met Joe face-to-face, he sang to me in the karaoke bar. So it was he sang one of his own songs, one of the ones he actually wrote and sang himself.
Oh, yeah, because there's been some drama about him not singing his own songs, right?
Yeah, him singing then, songs, or is it not him?
Some songs are really him, like about six or seven songs were the ones he wrote and sang himself. But then there's other songs that he didn't, that he wrote or helped write. But there was another dude named Vince who sang them. But yeah, so he sang me this song, and you know, I was a little tipsy maybe, but he was like super friendly to everybody in the bar. Like, it's just, he has a really strong energy and it kind of like draws people to him. So yeah, it was just kind of, I wanted to get to know him more, you know?
He's clearly a very, very charismatic guy. And that's
and very opinionated, yeah. And he's not afraid to speak his mind.
But that's also come, you know, got him in trouble. And I think, like, you know...
Definitely, yeah.
Has anything that you've heard since the show, like, shocked you or surprised you? Because I know I read some things about him making racist comments that were taken out of the show and all those kind of
things.
Yeah,
see, people tried to say that, like, he was racist. But, I mean, there was people of all ethnicities and backgrounds working at the zoo. You know, I never saw Joe do anything that was even a little bit racist. I mean, people are going to say that. Obviously, you know, he may say some dumb things sometimes, but in front of the camera, Joe is like a completely different person. Behind the camera, when he's at home, he's like sweet, like super caring, like romantic. And it's like things that people did not see in front of the camera. And, you know, he wanted to grab people's attention, and being a big old mushy baby is not going to do that. So he was going to be the most outgoing person he could possibly be.
Okay. Yeah.
And how do you keep quite a spicy romantic relationship with someone who's in prison? Like, you know, you get to speak to him, what, 2-3 times a day? Like, how do you maintain it?
You see, I mean, like, sexually, I'm not, like, the most, like, that's not what drives me. You know, I'm more of a quality time kind of person. So, like, our conversations are always, like, just very positive and uplifting. Obviously, we don't have, like, sex phone calls over his jail stuff.
Would that be legal if someone did that? Would that be okay? Would they not be okay with that? How does that work?
You know, I have no idea. Obviously, I have not been in that situation.
Yeah.
But I feel like it would be really weird and awkward, and it's just weird. But yeah, our conversations are just like more uplifting. Like, he's like, oh, he really loves my dog a lot. And he's like, what's my dogger doing? You know, 'cause she's a girl. And he just like always talks about how, you know, he used to play with her in the yard and stuff. He's like, I miss throwing the frisbee to her, or taking her to the beach, and you know, things of like just to make him feel positive about coming home. That's what really makes him happy.
So are you thinking that he will get an early release? I know that there's been obviously President Trump being involved, and all these kind of crazy kind of things you probably could never have even conceived of, you know, this when you were filming it. What do you think?
There's definitely a possibility, you know. I mean, if he doesn't get the pardon from President Trump, then, you know, we're at least hoping for a lesser sentence after this appeal process. But Joe is a huge Trump supporter. I really do not give two craps about politics, because it really never works out in anybody's favor unless they're nuts. But so, you know, he was super excited to hear that Trump even said his name. It was a big deal for him. You know, but Trump, he kind of, in my opinion, blew it off as a joke. He was like, oh, what do you think? What do you think? Oh, you can't really answer that because you're a reporter. So, you know, and then he was like, oh, I'll look into it. Next question. Mm-hmm. So we'll see kind of what happens with that. I mean, fingers crossed, you know, we're going to hope for the best, but you never know.
You could end up being in the White House before you know it.
Stunning. Has there been any update with Trump? Has he updated anything? He said anything else? Or was it just that one comment?
Just the one comment, yeah. I mean, we'll see what happens. But I don't ever want to get my hopes up. You know, I've done that in the past where I'm like thinking like, yeah, oh, this is going to work. It's happened the whole time Joe's been in jail, you know, so then, you know, every time it's kind of a letdown when it doesn't work out. So I don't want to be too hopeful, but I'm going to stay positive and, you know, really think realistically, like what could possibly happen. And so if he doesn't get the pardon, hopefully lesser sentence.
I mean, there's been a lot of talk and also like a lot of, like we were saying earlier, the lot of things that have come out since. What have you made about the discussions that he had been abusing the animals and then that?
Okay, so I really want to make this clear. When everyone is saying that Joe abused his animals, they are referring to the cub petting. So using the tiger cubs. But never once did Joe ever lay a hand on one of his animals. Okay, you have to really think about it, okay? If Joe is going to go every single day, multiple times a day, into a cage with 10-plus big cats, full-grown big cats at that, do you really think he would ever walk out alive, and he'd been doing that for 15 years? Mm-hmm. If he once abused them, as in beat them, they would have attacked him immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, they have so much power. And, I mean, you can see even in the documentary, he will reach his hands through the cages or go into the cages and just rub their faces. They'll rub all over him. That's love. Yeah. That is not anything other than that, you know?
So why do you think it's being said then? Why do you think people are saying that? Is it people with an axe to grind
it's the animal rights activists. And I mean, I understand, you know, cub petting, because it kind of desensitizes the animals, and, you know, and a tiger is an exotic animal, belongs in the wild, but that's what they refer to as abuse, is using the cubs for your own gain. So, I mean, in a sense, they may be right, but they also may be wrong. because cub petting can also lead to great educational purposes. People don't know that much about wild animals like that. But, you know, if you show them love and respect, they're going to treat you with the same respect back. And it took me, you know, I learned all of that being at the zoo. I learned so much about these animals that I never would have known if I wasn't able to personally interact with them. And you can't just go into a cage with a full-grown cat that's never been around you and think that you're going to walk out alive, because they're going to test you, and they're going to be like, oh, what can I do to this person, you know? So it's definitely a bond that you create with the animal when you raise them from a baby till they're full-grown.
Yeah, it's interesting how the rules are so different as well, because in America, you can do those kind of things that I don't think you can do in Europe. I don't know why.
No,
I don't know what the rules are, but yeah, I mean, it is very interesting. What is next for you, Dylan? Are we going to see you on Dancing with the Stars or something?
Everyone keeps asking me that. I mean,
I feel like it's a yeah. All you need is just a glittery jacket. You know, it's fine.
Maybe not a glittery jacket. That was a Joe thing, not a me thing. I'm more hip hop. Tank tops and swimming trunks is my kind of thing. But
you can't dance in swimming trunks.
Yeah, no.
Don't tell me. I can do it.
Ian Boltzmann.
We're joined now by Juno Dawson.
Hello.
Now, talk to Juno for a bit while I look at this.
Juno, we're calling Juno friend of the show because we've decided, I think you heard, that we either have friends or enemies of the show. You've been on before and you're a returning guest, so yes. You are clearly a best friend of the show.
Although I've been in the studio, I keep moving away from the mic. It's not helpful, is it?
Stop doing that.
I've been in to visit Hannah Witton and Callum McSwiggan back in the day.
Yes.
So I'd interviewed you on the phone.
Yes.
Is what happened. Then I met you and didn't make the connection.
No, I can't remember which happened first. I don't know whether the interview came first or
it was the interview.
I think it was the interview first.
Because, we met at the Mind Media Awards.
Yeah, I enjoyed that night greatly. I was quite conflicted that evening. Mm. And I think, actually, because we did an interview afterwards.
Yes.
I doubt it was ever used, because I don't think I was very good in it. Because I was a little bit discombobulated, and I think I was trying to explain to you in the interview, I'd kind of disengaged from mental health work at that point and then won this award, which was like, oh, shit, no, I'm not doing that now. I'm not doing that. And it was...
The mental podcast.
That's right,
yeah.
Which I was delighted. I really was delighted to win the award. It did mean a lot, genuinely did at the time, so I'm not being disingenuous about that, but I had decided at that point that I didn't want to discuss that sort of thing as part of my public profile anymore.
Yeah.
I'd thought about it a lot, and I tried to work it out, and I was like, I don't think I'm doing good now. I don't think this is either good for me, or I think there's now an explosion of it that might be damaging, potentially, is how I was feeling. So it was quite a conflict for me that evening. But it was... very positive and quite inspiring, I thought.
I mean, I love it as an award, and I mean, Mind works so hard. I think I'm about to be on the cover of their magazine, as it happens.
Oh, yeah.
So I think they do great stuff. But I think you're right. I think there is a danger in making mental health too central and defining to your personality.
Yeah.
It can become, hello, my name is Juno, and I'm anxious.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, and it shouldn't, you know, I spend my life trying to get away from anxiety.
Of course.
So I don't kind of particularly want it to define me too much.
Yeah. Well, I worry about the fetishization of it. That's what I worry about.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to feel party to that movement of contributing to that, even though I knew that wasn't my intention with it. You know, I didn't like the idea of somebody thinking, well, have I got to be like a bit bonkers as well? Is that because that everyone is at the moment? So have I got to as well? Which... then, you know, everything just gets out. It's a tsunami of stuff then, isn't it?
Yeah.
It all gets out of control. So that was my consideration of it. And we spoke to, I can't remember the dude who came in, who was doing a new mental health podcast. And
we had quite a Matt long... Johnson, he had a new podcast.
That's right, we had quite a long discussion about that, didn't we?
Yes.
On that one. But first and foremost, is this first and foremost, your A1 job is writing?
Yeah. I suppose it's funny because I'm a big fan of, do you know Emma Gannon, the podcaster, and she always talks about being multi-hyphen.
Okay.
So I suppose I am author hyphen screenwriter hyphen, what else do I do? Podcaster, all sorts of things.
Portfolio career.
Exactly.
Yeah. I learned that about a year ago and I've used it ever since.
I like
it. Portfolio career, yeah.
Lots of strings to my bow, yeah. But author is by far and away the day job, and that's what makes me happiest.
What's the... I'm going to come on to your book, but what is the drive behind that with being... multi-hyphened, why?
To survive, really.
Is it financial?
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. So I got my first book deal in 2011 and I gave up my day job. I used to be a teacher and as it turns out, I thought I'd got a great big book deal, but in real life it didn't translate to being that. And so very quickly I realised that journalism was a really good way to kind of top up my income, and my non-fiction writing is really what has kept me going.
Okay. So how much of what you actually do now would you, if you could strike it off, if money wasn't, no, Jane, question, if money wasn't an issue, is there other elements of your career now, you don't have to say what they are, but are there elements of your career now that you go, I don't want to, that you're working towards not having to do that anymore?
No, I don't think there is.
No,
I think
that's a healthy place, isn't it?
Because I'm really looking, my last book did really, really well and has opened up lots of doors.
Okay.
And so at the moment, and I haven't been able to say this ever before, I'm just doing projects that I really want to do.
Good.
I nearly said that I was passionate about, but you should never say that you're passionate about anything other than sex.
For why? Really? Do you think that?
I just think, I mean, I'm really passionate about fruit. Really? Like what?
Like, would you never like make a creative work and go, that deserves a wank? That chapter I've just written deserves a wank.
No, I'm mostly treating myself with cake, if I'm honest. So it's just slightly different. And seeing my boyfriend literally looking through a window now. So.
I'm so prolific, I'm up to about 10 a day. I'm
like, 10 chapters.
That was an amazing, amazing sentence.
You've done a good chapter, right? Have a little break. In fact, actually, Hannah used to talk on our show about, you know, some people go for a cigarette break. If I've done something good, she'll go for a wank break.
Oh, really? Is that right?
That's actually not an unusual, though. She probably didn't say wank, masturbation break. That's actually not that uncommon that you're saying that.
I couldn't make the link between feeling creatively sated and horny.
Why not treat yourself?
The two things wouldn't cross over to me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't think. Oh. Sorry. Oh,
well. So, no, yes, I'm, quite happily doing just things that I'm enjoying at the moment, which is really cool.
I've got a feeling, you know, because I same, right? And I've got a feeling, I mean, this apart, but I've got a feeling that if you just decide to do that anyway... Like, even if financially, if you stop thinking about money, even if you just decide, I am just going to do the things I want to do, I feel like that it would follow anyway.
Yeah. I mean, because I'm always saying, it's a piece of advice I've always, always given, is don't get too hung up on these all or nothing kind of mentalities. And I've heard people say, oh, you know, I don't want to, you know, if I was going to be a writer, I'd want to give up my day job, which is a lovely notion.
Right.
But not everybody can afford to do that. And so when I'm in schools talking to young people, I always say, my dad used to get a trade. But you don't necessarily have to get a trade. But, you know, if you want to be a singer, sing. If you want to be an artist, paint or sculpt. Just if it's not making you any money, you will find that time in your life to do it. And I think, you know, if something was to go catastrophically wrong and my writing wasn't making me any more money, you know, I'd have to get a different job, but I would absolutely stay writing.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't let that stop me for a second.
No, and that's it. But I honestly feel like it just naturally follows. I honestly feel like if you've got to be good at it as well. Let's make no bones about it. But if that is your natural calling, if such a thing exists, then I think it's that classic thing of going, don't sit and wait for it. Do it. Do the work. Don't wait for a commission. Have the work ready in case you then get a commission. Go, I've done it. Mm. There it is.
Patrick Nis always says, you can read joy on the page.
Yeah.
And I really buy into that. And I know because my book, Clean, was the most fun I'd had in years.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it was Clean is by far and away my bestseller now.
Yeah.
And I think that was because, you know, it's not always a fun and easy read, but I think you could tell that I was having an absolute blast with that character.
Yeah.
So I think now, and again, I'm very fortunate to be in the position where I wouldn't work on a novel if I wasn't having as much fun as I was having with Clean.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We are back. We're back in the studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my living room and Nat's in his washroom. And we are live. We're not live. We're pre-recorded on a Wednesday. And we're joined now by Hollywood royalty director Simon West and actor Jason Isaacs. Yeah, unbelievable that you're both on our show. Thank you so much for coming to be here.
Pleasure. That unbelievable. Just sitting in our front rooms. I don't know about Simon, but I'm getting out of having to cook dinner by talking to you. Please keep it going. I might get out of the washing up.
I'm getting a school run, actually. So,
you're in Oxfordshire at the moment, aren't you, Simon?
I am, yes.
And where are you, Jason?
I'm a lot closer to Cricklewood than Hollywood, I'll tell you that. I'm in London.
Right. Okay. Oh, yeah. So am I. Oh, I'll see you afterwards. One of my favourite films that I've seen, I think I saw it just before lockdown, and then I saw it during lockdown, is Con Air. And obviously,
that is, I think it was an 18 certificate when it came out in, I think I had to sneak into the cinema with, my parents took me. And obviously the gore and the violence in that is kind of extreme.
But it's funny you should say that, because I think now Con Air is so tame in terms of violence or gore or language or anything like that. I mean, it's like a PG film now.
It's and not.
If you watch a modern action film, it is so violent and the language is so strong that I think Con Air is, that's why I think it can be shown anytime to anyone now. It's because it's so tame compared to, you know, the time it was.
Yeah, compared to a Netflix series, even compared to many, sure, many things on television.
I mean, what part of Con Air is incredibly gory?
The bit when you move Danny Trejo at the end and his arms are still hanging there.
But you don't even see, like, his arms.
I know, but your imagination, you know, your imagination.
That's a whole different thing.
Yeah,
but say Psycho's gory because of that. You see blood running down a plug. That's good filmmaking.
Yeah, but now you see people cut in half, you know, with swords and heads flying off, and you see, you know, the whole effect. It is so realistic, and I think it's very tame, Connor, and I think that's why you can still watch it, you know, with your grandma, because
you are personally responsible for inflicting upon the world something between, I think, 700 and 800 Nicolas Cage action movies. Because he had not done one before.
It was part of his late 90s resurrection, wasn't it? He did The Rock, Con Air, and then Face Off.
Right.
And so you were like...
I don't think I'm solely responsible, but...
No, I'm giving you the blame. You're the only one on the Zoom with me.
No, to share the blame. And, you know, and in The Rock, he was, you know, a nerd who had to, you know, a science nerd who had to come with... In Con Air, he's a full-blown...
Yeah.
He certainly is, yeah.
He's in the... Yeah. I mean, I remember going to... We did part of the research there. We went to a lot of prisons in the States, which was the scariest thing. We went to Folsom Maximum Security Prison.
Wow.
And walking out on the yard with Nick Cage, and there's 2,000, you know, hardened criminals there who are, you know, they're all, you know, it's not, it's Folsom Maximum Security. It's for the guys that are too bad to go into the normal prisons. And you have to sign a waiver before you go in saying that, you know, if you get held hostage, you won't sue the state if they kill you or they cut your fingers off, and you get this whole instruction, like if a fight breaks out, because there's no guns, the guards don't have guns down on the ground because they just get grabbed off them. So the only guards with guns are up in the towers. So you walk out in the yard and they say, if a fight breaks out, hit the ground, because everybody knows all the other inmates will hit the ground, and the only people left standing will be people in the fight, and that's who they'll shoot at. So you have all this going through your head when you're walking in of like, okay, if I get held hostage, there's nothing I can do about it. If there's a fight, I've got to, you know, and everyone's, you're walking out with Nick Cage, and everyone's getting interested, and they're coming around, and they're gathering. And of course, everyone's in their separate gangs. You know, everyone is affiliated to a different gang. So these, you know, they're coming in these great groups, and they start circling around. And it all starts off very friendly, and then they want, you know, an autograph, then they want a part in the next movie, and then they want to touch Nick, and then a fight breaks out, and we run for it. Yeah, I mean, and we interviewed lifers, and we walked into the, you know, all the cells and everything. I mean, it was pretty hardcore.
I thought you were going to say that they said, if a fight breaks out, just make sure you win.
Yeah, there was no chance of winning.
That's your first, like, feature-length movie. Was that...
Yeah.
Was it intimidating when you sort of... when you have that cast? Or is it just something you kind of... you walk in and it's like, I'm in charge, this is... I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's both. It's... I'd done a lot of commercials... So, which the most is 7-day shoot is a long, long commercial. So it's more of a stamina thing. So I had a lot of technical expertise. So I'd been directing commercials and documentaries and things like that since I was 22. And so I had like 14 years professional shooting. I thought I knew everything, you know, and you walk on the set, you go, yeah, I can do this. And you realize, you know, after the end of the first day that you're completely overwhelmed, and like, how am I? I remember turning to the DP and go, like, after the first day, and going, like, how am I going to do another 100 of these days? Because you are dealing with 500 person crew, massive, you know, experienced actors, and you've got to, you know, keep the machine rolling. So
It was overwhelming, but there's also, you don't know what you don't know, I suppose, and a naivety. And, you know, half the people there are supportive and the half are very unsupportive because, they go, why should you be doing this? And quite rightly so, after a while you sort of, you see their point of view, like, why should I be doing this? This is ridiculous, And
so what's the answer? The answer, how am I getting through 100 days is one day at a time.
Well, it's just, you just put your head down. And after, I remember hitting day 30 and hitting a wall and go, I can't go on. Because it's, you're shooting long hours, you're working 7 days a week, and you're trying to deal with 1,000 personalities and try and make a good film on the side as well as running the factory. And then after a few more days, you get into the swing. It's like a marathon runner, I suppose. And then it becomes your daily job. You clock in at, 7 in the morning, you clock off at 9 at night, and you're going to come back the next day. And you don't realise that it will end one day, because that's your daily job. And I remember when I was looking, obviously particularly shattered, the line producer coming over to me and saying, you do realise one day this film will be finished, don't you? And I went, oh, yeah, it will be. Well, I don't have to do this for the rest of my life. This is, you've got like a morale booster. Yeah, so it was difficult, but incredibly satisfying. People always say, and even the writer came up to me in the beginning of the film and said, Are you excited? I said, no, I'm not excited. I'm terrified. I'm excited when I go somewhere, to a spa or something, to have a relax, but you don't get excited. I'm terrified.
Which part did you audition for, Jason?
Oh, probably the part that was a very, very close toss-up between me and John Malkovich or something like that. I can't remember. Something I would have had no hope of getting. I think I was in there because my then-friend, Colleen, was... So I'm still my friend, but she was then Simon's assistant. I think I sneaked in under the radar and was booted out.
I think was too young and handsome to play the band.
Oh, God bless you.
In fairness, I did offer Jason like 3 or 4 films afterwards, which he all turned down, so...
I have a single criteria. Will I make another twat of myself? It's never who's making it, what's the money. They think I'm good enough to do this. I know I'll make a twat of myself and never work again. That is the first hurdle.
You would have been in Armageddon probably only a year or so later, so you sort of would have had that experience of that big kind of Jerry Bruckheimer.
Oh, yeah. Really, on the same trip, I went to audition for Armageddon. I remember the agent saying, oh, you have to go and meet Michael Bay for the space film. And I went, what script? They said, there's no script. And I went, well, obviously there's a script. How are they going to make a film without a script? There must be. Well, you can't see it. And I said, well, I'm not going. Because I was young and arrogant, didn't care. And my career was in England. I lived in England. It was just a holiday for me. And they said, well, you're not at a level where you get to see the script. I said, well, I'm not at a level where I'm going to the meeting. And they, I must have been like 12 or 23 or something. And they, I went to this meeting. They said, well, they said you can go an hour early. And I went to a room which was glass on 3 sides, and some assistant came in, put a script down on my lap, which is printed on dark maroon paper. I could barely make out a font. And he gave it to me and said, you have 1 hour. Please don't read out loud. As if I had a microphone. So anyway, I read the thing, and then 9 months later, I'm in Belfast. I've been there for a week rehearsing with the IRA, about to make a Northern Irish comedy. It's Sunday night. It's 3 a.m. on Monday morning. I get a phone call, and they go, hey, Jason. Hi, I have Mary and Tom and Bert and George and Fred from ICM on the phone. I went, it's 3 a.m. And they went, yeah, I know. They're calling from, and then we have Marcy from Disney and like 5 other people. I don't understand what's happening. Anyway, this guy comes on the phone. I didn't have an agent in America. He'd babysat me when I'd been there 6 months earlier. He said, wonderful news. Michael Bay wants you to be in Armageddon. I went, who's that? Remember when you were here in March? I said, I don't remember. The space movie? I said, yeah, I don't. Okay. He goes, and they want you to play Tom. And I said, who's that? we don't know. We didn't read the script. Do you remember? I said, I don't remember. They said, well, it's an astronaut, one of the astronauts, and you get to go and train at NASA, and you're going to go on the Vomit Comet, and, you're one of the guys. It's a wonderful thing. And I said, well, that's great. So there's only one thing. And I said, what's that? And they went, it starts on Tuesday. And I went, what Tuesday? They went, this Tuesday. I went, well, I'm shooting in 4 hours. I'm on the set. It's the first day of shooting tomorrow. They went, you let us take care of that. And I said, no, you can't take care of it. I'm a professional actor. This is a job. They went, honey, Jason, listen to me. This is a Bruce Willis project. And I said, this is a David Thewlis project. It doesn't matter who's in it. I'm a professional actor on a set, and I'm shooting in the morning. And then there was a strange silence. And I went, Mary, George, Joe, Ringo, Burr, anyone, anyone, there's this microphone working. They're like, we'll call you back. I said, don't call me back. I mean, anyway, so the part I ended up playing in Armageddon was the kind of dusty bin consolation part they offered me. And I was there the whole time, and whenever the actors would do, there is a hierarchy always on all films, but whenever those actors would swan by and give me the slight snake eye from the side, I'd be thinking, I was offered your fucking part. They couldn't do it. Couldn't do it.
So when you did the first Harry Potter, it was a very small part that sort of like blossomed into an ongoing part in the series. Did you know when you accepted that originally that it was going to become such a huge franchise? Because there was only like a couple of books that came out originally by the time the first film came out.
King, all the things that are wrong with what you just said. I'm so sorry. What? Only because... There were four books out. They were already the biggest books in the world. And I was offered a part in the second film. In the second film, I had a very big part. It diminished as the things went on. And each time I thought, should I go back to do the next? I mean, there's really not much to do. And then David Heyman, who's the nicest man in the world, who produced it, went, look, we want you back, but it's not a very big part. We can't pay you any more money. And you did make a bed for yourself by coming up with that wig. We could put it on someone else. So actually, my biggest part was in the first one that I did. And no, I didn't think of it as the biggest film in the world or as a franchise, because my experience is going to the set and telling a story with people in costume, and I did many jobs in between. Other people can use a word like franchise because they make lunchboxes or open theme parks, but for me, sure, they're a lovely bunch of people I went to make a film with, and then every 2 years I'd go back and play a slightly smaller part. But I did it because who doesn't want to hear Julie Walters tell stories about a pig farm, you know, next to the tea urn? And I remember on the last film, being there, that we're doing the big open battle sequence, and it was 2 weeks we were watching Rafe, who I've known, you know, with the same age, known him forever, do this huge monologue. 2 weeks I'm sitting there going, and Helen McCrory, who played my wife and our sister, went, I don't know how you fucking put up with this for 10 years. I cannot stand it. And I started to feel sorry for myself. I looked around and I thought, do you know what, I've got 3 lines in the next 2 weeks, that's all I got. And I looked over there and I saw Emma Thompson, she got an Oscar. Maggie Smith's got an Oscar. Jim Broadbent's got an Oscar. Someone else got an Oscar. And Julie Walters got an Oscar. And I thought, they haven't got any lines. At least I've got 3 lines. So it's some consolation. But the great joy of Harry Potter, unlike almost everything, and I loved making Skyfire. I loved being on the set. I loved hanging out with Simon. It's enormously good fun. The pleasure in Harry Potter is the opposite of everything I've ever done. It all came afterwards. It's all come in the effect it's had on people, the comfort it gives to people, the cultures built up around it. People who come up and tell you sincerely, and I believe them, that it saved their life, you know, or it's shone a light on them when they're in darkness.
Joey Page on FUBAR Radio. It's now time to welcome into the studio a very, very fine couple of guests. I'm very, very pleased with the bookers indeed for this one. Please welcome to the studio Judith Owen and Harry Shearer.
Hello. Hello. We retired at 1 o'clock and we came out of retirement at 1:30.
Yes, great. We did, and what time are you going back into retirement?
2:30.
2:30.
2:30.
All right, great.
Just to make a whole day of it.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. So thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely.
It's lovely to have you here. So
how long have you been married then?
150 million years and it doesn't seem like
what's
a day.
What's your secret?
Too,
what's your secret?
And how many Christmases? You're not a good lawyer.
Yeah. How many Christmases have you spent over there in the wrong part of the weather?
Oh, a lot now, actually. A lot. I'd say probably
20 or 19.
No, 15 years.
15?
So 15. So the last, it's 15 years since you had a proper Christmas in the right
weather. No, the last few, we've been divided up over 20 years. So I've had 15 there and I've had 5 here, I'd say.
Okay.
But in all honesty, Christmas I love here. It's the bit that follows Christmas. It's the January through March that I find really tough.
Right.
Don't we all?
You lot need another holiday where you put up lights in about mid-February.
The truth is, I mean, we find ways to work together. If we don't get to actually work together and do things together, we will never see each other.
Just come off the road after three months.
Touring Europe. So.
Musical artist.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you don't make that effort, you won't actually get to see each other. Yeah. But it is the secret, actually, to success in marriage.
Good.
Is don't spend too much time
together.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
No, I mean, I have a fantastic relationship with my ex-wife.
Oh, I love you.
Really? We get on so well.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
you never see her.
Because we don't see each other. And,
there you go.
Yeah.
And you like it that way.
And when we do see each other, we really like each other.
Oh, you!
We're really nice to each other.
Yeah.
I swear. It's
big smiles.
Yeah. It's part of it.
Disingenuous Trevor.
No, excuse me. Trevor's the man that said the very famous words, Bon Marie.
Bon Marie, yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, we're going to get on to that in a minute because we've got, I've got a little sort of quiz that I do with my guests that I'm going to do for you two in a minute. Right. And there's a cooking question, so I'll get to that in a minute. But so you're already kind of 1-0 down, Judith. But I'll see what I've got. Well, what questions I can write in that might level it up.
She hasn't told you yet about how the last time she tried to cook, it was at Christmas in Los Angeles a couple of years ago. And I roast a goose every Christmas, and we get not the same goose, but you know, new one every year. and she gets a I don't know if you have this here. It's called a turducken, which is a it's a turkey stuffed with a duck, which is stuffed with a chicken.
Right,
so three birds.
They don't go
three
in.
Birds.
They don't go in, you know, by choice.
No, it's not very hard. It's not like the little old lady who swallowed the fly.
No, they weren't following the breadcrumbs in. But you slice it, and it's like a galantine, Anyway, so Judith said, and she likes the Christmas.
You were doing the goose, and I was doing
the parsnips and the roast potatoes.
Sweet sprouts, parsnips, and the gravy is very, very, thank you, Harry. Very, very important stuff.
Classy.
And I'd spend the morning telling him how he'd ruined my life and crying because I really find Christmas Day a bit hard. That's another the conversation altogether. And he said, look, just make some gravy.
I didn't say that.
Oh, all right. I said, I'll make the gravy. For God's sake. This is what we're like. No, I mean, obviously that's what I like. And so Harry's cooking his goose. That's not
a metaphor.
That's not a double entendre. He's cooking his goose.
But soon after, my goose was almost cooked.
It was cooked. I look terrible. I'm snotty and awful because I've been crying. I really do struggle with Christmas. And then I'm stirring the gravy, and it's not, it doesn't, the goose fat's not strong enough and rich enough. And I say, you understand this, Trevor. And I say, do you have any stock? And Harry says, yes, there's some stock in the door of the fridge. So I grab, in my blinded, puffy-eyed state, I grab the stock and I start pouring it into the saucepan. And then I realize there's something blue coming out of the stock. And
blue and furry.
Blue and furry?
Well, it's basically mold penicillin. And so I think, thank you, Trevor. Thanks, Trevor. So then I think, oh, I'm not going to waste it. So I think I'll burn it off.
I'll boil it off.
How bad would that be?
Right.
Come on.
Yeah, exactly.
This is why wives are like your ex-wife.
More like a scientist than a cook.
Well, I thought a scientist.
A mad scientist.
I thought, I would burn it off. And then
reduce the penicillin.
Laugh really helps.
I managed to be in denial, total denial, about the fact that Harry has a very, very dangerous allergic reaction to penicillin. Ooh. And then we ate dinner. And we had our guests with us, our two poor human guests and a whole bunch of dogs. And at some point, Harry turned yellow and said, excuse me. And we didn't see him for an hour. And I figured that was a bad message. And then our guests turned to us at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd only started eating probably 3:34. And they went, well, we should probably go. I mean, this is the worst Christmas of all time. And then they left. And then basically she went outside and vomited for 45 minutes straight outside the front door.
Wow.
Without me knowing. Meanwhile, Harry's dying upstairs, you know, and it still has some.
And you're sat at the table finishing your Christmas.
Oh, I was eating everything in sight, but not the gravy or seekers. And I thought, well, at what point shall I tell him what I've done? Because this is so typical of me. You're like, you're in shock.
So you realise.
No. I'm really
anymore,
enjoying this story.
This is marriage.
Marriage is sounding better all the time, isn't it?
Quite late.
But there's a point where you realise.
At a point, I had an epiphany and thought, oh my God. God, it was penicillin, wasn't it? Of course, I understand. And by that time...
Well, it was mold.
It was mold. And by that time, I'd noticed the fever had broken in Harry and that he'd stopped sweating so badly and he'd had some more colour in his cheeks. I realised he wasn't going to... You know, nothing... It was too late for me to go to the emergency room.
Yeah.
And he survived the night. And then the next morning, I said to him, you'll never guess what I did.
Yeah, this will give you
laughing.
A good laugh.
I was laughing.
She said. She introduced it that way. You'll get a good laugh out of that.
Good laugh out of this, and to be fair, because he does have a sense of humor, you did laugh.
I laughed, yes,
yeah, because you were alive, mainly. Well, yeah.
I was laughing with relief.
Yes, that was the last time I cooked.
That makes sense.
Good on you for trying on such a difficult menu.
Yeah, however,
Christmas dinner is the hardest thing.
Planning now to come out with her own cookbook, Cooking with Fur.
I actually do want to do that. And have like everything I'm holding, like, you know, It's got blue fur on it. Just like Judith Ayn cooking with fur. It's my first foray into books.
I reckon this is.
I think it's got potential.
You're all invited.
But it's,
what are we doing? I can't think what I might be.
I don't know what it is.
All right.
I'm not allergic to penicillin. You know,
I don't know if I am, but it's one way to find out.
Isn't it?
James Acaster on Fubar Radio.
David Trent has arrived. Right, if you're not going to talk, I've spent all this time waiting for you,
yeah.
And then you don't even talk when I say hello to you.
You didn't say hello, you just said I've arrived. I thought you were going to fill in.
What do you think was going to happen?
I don't know.
I'm not going to give you all your credits.
Okay,
and stuff
try again. Let's go again.
Okay, I'll do a proper one.
Okay.
Joining me in the studio,
yep.
He was nominated for Best Newcomer at the Edinburgh Festival in 2011 and right, still doesn't shut up about it.
Now, this is something that I wanted to bring up.
Yes.
Not immediately, but obviously I did need to.
Well, you were going to bring it up at some point.
They still print it on posters. I don't tell anyone to print it on posters or anything.
Right.
Only that, though. You, they say, three times, it's year after year, it's all right, it's a rolling thing for you.
Yes.
For me, they say 2012. It's starting to look a little bit like...
2012, was it?
That's 3 years ago.
Yeah, definitely.
Too long ago. Why do they keep putting it?
stop putting it, guys.
Well, Sam Fletcher was nominated in the same year as you, David, yep. And I saw his poster, and it just said, nominee Foster's Edinburgh Comedy Awards Best Newcomer.
Well,
and then they left off the year, and I thought, that's clever.
Those people are clever, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't put, he was nominated for something but in 1942.
Your one's more honest to the audience. It lets them know he was nominated, but he's achieved nothing since. Like, they're letting them know in this amount of time.
Literally done nothing.
This is the last thing you did.
Well, I mean, that's quite true. But then I've got other friends who are... equally is managing to make a bigger success fuss of themselves when they've never been nominated, so, you know.
Yeah.
So I've got my Samsung Galaxy S5 here.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna use Spotify rather than an iPod Shuffle. Now,
you
I'm
can
concerned...
Put it on shuffle,
there's
you?
A couple of things I'm concerned about as well.
Go
concerned
on.
About the Spotify Shuffle algorithm.
For the iPod already? Huh?
The algorithm.
Yeah, what about it?
I don't think it shuffles very thoroughly. What do you think about with the iPod?
Great. Shuffles really well.
Consistently surprised.
Yeah.
Do you get good days and bad days?
Yeah. I haven't had a repeat song on here yet.
I've been listening to it on the drive down.
Yeah.
It's been very bad choices all the way down. But then some days you just get brilliant.
Before you got here, I said I was pretty sure you wouldn't have any bad choices on there. You'd be quite confident about all of your choices.
Well, it's not that it's bad or good.
Mm.
I'm confident that everything's pretty hipster, but because I'm a hipster... But with the Spotify, what you've got is you're much younger, and you've always had a digital collection, whereas I've got a whole vinyl collection, and I've started. It's like restarting.
Mm.
I've never sat down with my albums and put them all in.
Mm.
I've never sat there and gone, I'll put all my albums in. I haven't spent that much time on it. More go to Pitchfork, click on it, and it goes onto my iPad.
Right, you know though that. You've had a digital collection before me. Because you're the person who put pressure on me to do it.
Sure.
You thought it was hilarious.
But you've never gone to Spotify, have you? You've never moved over there. There's a big difference between Spotify and not owning it and owning it. And you curate your iPod.
Right, yeah.
And you curate your iTunes a lot more than you do with Spotify. It's just like, it's for the McDonald's. Fuck it.
So... this is the biggest disclaimer we've had so far on someone's... I mean, I thought you'd be the most confident. You appear to be the least confident.
I'm pretty confident. I'm pretty confident, but I think we'll have quite a number of... Yeah, well, I've got nothing to say about that track because I just put it on.
I've never known you to have nothing to say about something, David.
Well,
so
let's find out, shall we? Here we go.
See what track one is on David Trent's Spotify Shuffle. Just please press play right now, David.
I'm just a bit worried about the sound balance.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, here we go.
How professional has this show appeared so far?
How many listeners do we have?
It's just me and you.
Right, so let's not worry too much. Let's go. Ready?
Yeah, press.
Shuffle!
There we go. Shuffler, shuffler. David Trent.
Last night's
illusion that someone loved me. No hope, no harm, just another false alarm. Last night I felt real arms around me.
David Trent, off to an absolute flyer.
Well...
Come on.
I mean...
It's just the safe one, isn't it?
It's a classic
no
track.
No one's going to slag you off for that. And well, we played the intro, which is cooler.
They'd say it's from Strange Ways, not the strongest album.
Okay, they'll say that to you. Well, they're the Smiths fans.
There's a lot of... Some people think it is their finest hour, but there's a lot of synthesizers brought in.
Well, there's always people who always big up the album that everyone likes the least, or, you know, get people who go... Bleach is the best Nirvana album.
Everyone says that.
And you're like, no, it's not.
That's people who weren't there, though.
Yeah.
Or hipsters, like super hipsters. Or people like my friend Pat. Pat used to say Bleach was their best album.
Yeah.
Even though he wasn't listening to Bleach before Nevermind.
Yeah.
But he was... I think the thing is that if you're in the scene...
Yeah.
But you miss that one album.
Yeah.
That has to be your favourite. Like, we were definitely... I went to see Dinosaur Jr.
Yeah.
At Yulu. I had the Fluid albums. I had the Mudhoney albums. I just didn't notice Nirvana until Nevermind came out. And so right. They weren't really mine.
Yes.
You know? And that, I think that hurt a lot of people's feelings.
But, like, the whole Nirvana thing, people were made to feel like... They should have liked the early stuff because Kurt Cobain was being quite moody about it.
Well,
but which is a funny kind of mood in a way because it's the whole thing of like, yeah, this is for people who liked us before Nevermind because there's loads of people jumped on the bandwagon with Nevermind. It's like what when you wrote one of the best albums of all time and people liked it more than not the best album of all time.
Hmm.
That's basically what happened. You go, yeah, it's a better album, mate. That's why more people liked it.
There's a number of issues. I mean, there's the first of all. There's the production on that album.
Yeah.
So you know all about the production on that album.
Oh, never mind.
Yeah.
Butch Vig.
Mm.
Oh, not happy about that, are
you? Butch Vig produced it.
Yeah.
And then Andy Wallace engineered it.
Right.
Andy Wallace had engineered Rain and Blood by Slayer.
Yes.
And he gave it that massive sound that Slayer have got. And before the mix before that is it just hasn't got as much sheen.
Right.
And it was more like that sort of sub-pop sound that you would have, right? So I think... He said that he couldn't bear to listen to the album because he didn't like the way it sounded. He didn't think it represented him. And then there was a lot of cut and pastes on the solos, things like that. Like, when you'd hear them play it live, he couldn't reproduce even the work that they'd managed to get out of the studio. And if you actually listen to the guitar solos, it's not that different from In Utero. They have done a really good... Somebody came along and did an amazing production job on that. And if you listen to something like Silver or Slither, I don't know what it's called.
Slither.
But that stuff just sounds a lot smaller.
Yes.
And I think that's what he's talking about. I don't think he liked the way that they bigged it up. I don't know. Bleach is shit.
I like the way they bigged it up. I like Nevermind. I love it. Love that album.
Why is Amanda staring at me? What have I done?
Oh, don't get too paranoid about Amanda.
Really?
She'll just be thinking about some other stuff. She's got her own life, David. Oh. She's not looking at you, thinking about you all the time.
Okay.
David, we're going to play another track from your one. Is it all lined up? Are you ready to play?
This was on. It started playing.
Oh, it's carried on playing, has it?
Should I fart next one?
Yeah, do the next one and surprise yourself.
Here we go. The rocks are supposed to be like sea waves.
Fever there. Don't you worry. David, I've left David in control. I've never left a guest in control of their own device before. And I never will again. Can't believe what was it going on to there, David?
Apples in stereo. Joni, don't you worry. That was about 15 seconds as well.
Pretty cool, ain't it? Fever there. And the singer of Fever follows me on Twitter.
When we went to see Future of the Left, what did you say after the gig?
They're too loud.
Really angry. You would know. I said they're too loud. You went, that's a load of rubbish, Trent. Why'd you take us to that? Nothing interesting there. Nothing. I've seen that a million times before. That's what you said.
Yeah, I was angry.
But then you made friends with them, and then you listened to them, and you realised hooks are plenty.
I like that first album loads. I love it.
They're the best.
Yeah, it was too loud. That was my thing in that gig. It was so loud, and I couldn't hear it. I mean, I had two gigs with you, and you hated both of them.
I'm bad at going to gigs. I'm going to go see Kiss.
You're
going to
hate that.
Stay home and chill, keeping you company during the coronavirus.